I pinch myself, man. I can't believe it. Like, I don't, sometimes I don't really believe that it's the same life. Like, it's almost like one life ended, another one began. I mean it. Like, it's crazy, dude. Like, it's just wild. Like I have now 5 toys designed in my style, which happens to be a linoleum block print style. I was told by big name companies who's employed by friends of mine, and they said that my style would never work in 3D. It was too graphic. I didn't know better. I said, oh shit, okay, well, I'll keep trying. You know, and now there's 5 figures and you know, that are available. And then and a few of them sold out. And then, you know, I was at Comic-Con and I got to, and I'm hanging out talking to Jim Lee and like Frank Miller and shit. Like, I feel like this is all bullshit. Like, this is like how did it happen? You know, but it's your original question. Yeah. It was like, yeah, it was a desert out here.
If you're watching on YouTube, please like, subscribe, and leave a comment about the episode. And if you're watching on Spotify or listening on a traditional podcast platform, please follow, rate us 5 stars, and leave a review if you would be so kind. Thank you.
Welcome to the Way to Know You podcast, season 4, episode 41. My name is Nick Rounds, and I will be your host. My next guest is a senior creative director at Mono Toys and Collectibles, but he's also an accomplished independent artist in his own right. Known for his unique style of linoleum art transferred to Locta paper, he takes pop culture figures and translates them into handmade art. When he's not busy making block prints for his YouTube live audience, he's designing his next amazing kaiju creature toy with Mondo. Attack Peter, aka Peter Santa Maria.
What's up, dude?
Wait, I know you. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. Yeah, I just want to talk about all the amazing stuff that you do, both personally and also at Mondo. Huge fan of your work. Your artwork is so unique and creative, and just like an amazing mix match of like tattoo flash, like kaiju art. Like, it's just absolutely stunning, and I love everything that you do.
Oh man, thank you.
In addition to like the rad stuff that you get to do with Mondo as well. So I want to talk about all that stuff. So I guess right now, so I didn't know what linocut was before I like stumbled upon your work and making linoleum block prints. Can you talk more about like what that is specifically, and when did you start using that process?
Yeah, it's actually you know, a very old medium. It goes technically like casually referred to as printmaking, right? Printmaking, essentially, you make prints of an image by, in my case, carving a design into linoleum. A lot of people carve into wood, metal, you know, there's all kinds of different processes, but I do linoleum block printmaking. And, you know, I experimented a little bit with it in college, a little bit in high school. And then when I became a teacher, I was an art teacher for 13 years. It was always my students' favorite unit every year. Like, it was one that all kids got excited about. And at the time, I was doing a lot of painting and a lot of illustration. I wanted to be like the artist Scott Morris is my really big inspiration. Back then, he was, still to this day, is incredible. But I wanted to be someone who could paint with gouache and sell vinyl paint and all that. But my job, my lifestyle didn't allow for me to tear down and set up paint so often as a teacher. I was always like moving class to class. And so when I started just using little linoleum blocks, I could carve a whole design as part of a demo for students and then have a print made off of it. And so as part of my teaching, I was able to generate artwork. And so I just loved that. And then I also loved that I noticed there weren't a lot of people, or at all to my knowledge, doing printmaking in pop culture. You know, if you go into the gallery scene, you'll see a lot of different printmakers. You know, Swoon is probably one of the most famous ones. She does like linoleum block print street art. But in the pop culture scene, there weren't really any. So my buddy Brian and I started doing linoleum. Brian Reedy, who's another great printmaking artist. We started doing block prints at local Miami conventions, and it snowballed from there to doing more Florida conventions. And then finally, I was encouraged by the late, great Brian Ewing to take my work out of Florida and go to some shows in California, New York, and get my name out there. And by doing that, I exposed myself to a lot of great companies. And, you know, two of the first ones that gave me a shot were Sideshow Collectibles. And on their print run side, they gave me an opportunity to do a licensed Spider-Man print. And then Brian Flynn over at Super 7 gave me a shot to do a licensed Masters of the Universe t-shirt design based on one of my prints. And man, like that really helped me get my name out there even further. Then finally, I was able to do a design. I started doing some designs for Mondo in 2020, and I signed up with Skybound and in late 2019. And those two things together, like, just shot my name up into people's periphery. And then it just kind of like took off from there, man. So printmaking in pop culture helped me get the attention of a lot of people that were probably seeing artwork all over the place, you know, and that style just stood out among everything else, thankfully.
Totally. One of the things I really like about your Attack the Block series specifically is that you make it a live event and like an actual hangout, as opposed to just totally. Because most artists, like, especially with printmaking, or like if you're like, you know, printing a shirt,
yeah,
you're kind of like doing it behind the scenes and like, you know, just in the flow mode of doing it or whatever. And one of the things I really appreciate the fact is like you're doing it live in front of everybody else and making an actual hangout event, as opposed to like, I'm going to be doing this, you know, ad nauseum, listening to music or something.
Yeah. Yeah. That is definitely a carryover from teaching too, you know. It's an advantage I have that I spend 13 years with tons of kids in the classroom, you know, and every hour on the hour, have a new group of kids coming in. And finally, I had no choice but to get used to doing my work while teaching, while doing demos, you know, and explaining it. And in the most fun we ever had as classes is when it was like an open studio vibe where we were just hanging. Like everybody would learn a lesson, I would demonstrate a lesson, and then I'd have time to do a little bit more of the specific instruction table to table. And finally everyone's just go work, do your thing. And then if you needed help, if you had questions, you could come up and I would talk to you about it. But it was always a vibe. It was always work and talk and talk and work. And that primed me for my life now. And so my least favorite thing, excuse me, I've been fighting a yawn. So sorry.
It's all good.
I've been fighting it for like two questions. My least favorite thing about making artwork is the isolated aspect of it. Like I work alone a lot, you know, and then my favorite thing about making artwork is that people like it. And so therefore it becomes a reason to get together and to hang out. So Attack the Block print really just came out of that. I wanted to do something, you know, semi-regularly on YouTube. I wanted to have a reason for people to get together. So I figured I'll just do these little portraits inspired by these characters. You know, Gabby and I hang out, we talk, we go over the fun, entertaining stuff that's out in the news. And yeah, like talk to our friends in the chat. And it's just been the absolute best thing, the absolute best thing. And all that, you know, came from the pandemic when we had no conventions and had tried to figure out a way to keep in touch with everybody. So we taught ourselves how to be streamers. You know, still learning as we go, obviously, but we got it to the point where we can do it fairly simply. And we just enjoy doing it. It's work. It's stressful because there's always a technical glitch of some kind. But it's generated a lot of great friendships and connections with people. And I think it really helps people get to know us, you know, in as real people, you know, as when you start to follow artists and enjoy their work, you know, there used to be a barrier of like you as a fan and the artist as a creator and they're in their studio and you don't really have access to them. And so I used to go to conventions all the time, just wanted to ask them questions, talk to them, watch them work. I used to bring a camcorder to conventions and then get a commission, pay for a commission, and then film the commission happen.
Oh, wow.
So that I could like study it later, you know?
Were there any specific artists that you did that with?
Oh my God. Yeah. Scott Morse was one of them. In fact, I still have the paintings around here hanging in the other side of my room because he would just do live paintings. And they're incredible. And, you know, the balls that it takes to do that on the spot, someone watching you, and then do it in a stylistic way and making it feel complete by the end of it was so impressive to me. So I had, I used to film him. There was an artist named Andy Lee who's do sumi-e, Japanese drawings. But I mean, a ton of them. I can't even remember. It's just a, like, it was just a thing. Like, back then, people have to remember there was not as, there was no YouTube or anything like that. This was your only chance to like absorb that. And so I sometimes take it for granted and I think, who the hell wants to watch this shit? Like, who wants to sit here with us talking shit? You know, I get self-conscious about it because I'm like, I'm very sensitive to people's time. Like, how is this worth anybody's time? You know?
Well, and it's similar to like watching somebody play the guitar. Like, yeah. if you're watching like Eddie Van Halen play the guitar and yeah. you're watching the way he's like, you know, picking everything out, you want to see that slow down and like see the technique and everything. So if you're talking about like from an artist standpoint, that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, and it's just that I actually like my work. You know, a lot of artists don't like their work. I do like my work. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out something that I would enjoy. I don't hang my work in my house frequently, like a couple pieces, but I do like the process of it. I do like the end result, and I like that I found something that other people weren't doing. You know, I grew up as a huge fan of Mike Mignola and Frank Miller and guys whose work, when you see them, you knew it was them instantly. That was my most important goal. Get to a point where when people see your work, they know it's you. And if you do that, you're in good shape. And so I like my work. I like making it, and I like that it makes people happy. And so I think, if you're not there for the artwork, maybe you have fun hanging with us while we goof off and chat and crack jokes and all that. If you think we're annoying, maybe you're there for the artwork, and then that's good. And so there's it's just a hang. It's like an open studio. You know, when I was a kid, my stepdad was an artist in Cuba. And when I met him, when he started dating my mom, he had all these cool art friends that we would go down to the beach, Miami Beach. I'm from Miami. And I would go to their studios and just be in their open studio, walking around, just looking at everything. It was fascinating to me. And so becoming an artist over time and studying art history, being in classrooms full of materials, it can become very casual, like normal. I don't say mundane because it's negative sounding, but it's the norm and it's not other people's norm. And so bringing people in, I think, is a nice thing to do because, you know, I appreciate it when I get to watch anybody else at their craft doing anything that's interesting for me. So it's fun for me in that regard. I like it. I'm happy that people like it.
What was like the art scene like in Miami growing up? I mean, I guess mixing with growing up and then coming up, I guess those are kind of like two different questions.
Yeah. I mean, Miami's like, in the 90s and all that, it's very much a gallery scene and it wasn't anything really cool. Or like once a year we had Art Basel here in Miami, which still happens, and you'd get more outsiders coming down. But this is very like a lot of abstract conceptual stuff. There's also that era, that's what was happening. And everything that we like and that we're into was not really elevated at all. In fact, I went to art school here in Miami and everything, like legends in our business, you just hear people shit on it. Like it's nothing. Yeah. And it was strange. I hated it because I felt like, if you've seen that movie Art School Confidential, if you haven't had a chance to watch it, it's exactly what I went through. Oh, wow. And yeah. And so I played the game and I'm very competitive. And so I said at one point, fuck it, dude, I'm going to do your shit. And I'm going to, can we curse on this podcast? I didn't mean to.
Yeah. Yeah. Go for it.
Okay.
If you feel like cursing, you can.
It just comes out sometimes, but yeah.
Okay. I would have told you ahead of time if I was.
Oh, no, you're fine. But, I say, you know, if this is what we're going to do, I'm going to do it and I'm going to do it really well. And I'm going to beat you at your own game, but then I'm going to do my shit, you know? And so I did it. I passed the classes I had to pass. I got the marks I needed to get. And then I started doing my own thing again. But there was nothing down here. It was awful. It was like a dead zone. So it wasn't until like I started discovering message boards in the early 2000s that I felt like there was a way out. You know, like if you can believe it, in the early 2000s, I did not know what Comic-Con, like I knew what Comic-Cons were, but I didn't know that San Diego Comic-Con was the biggest and most important one. We didn't know about it. And back then the Comic-Con website was dog shit. I don't know if you remember that. It was like, like it was such a bad website. So when I finally saved up a bunch of money to travel to a convention, I didn't choose San Diego. I chose Wizard World Chicago because the website was slicker and I got, you know, you could see the guests' pictures and all that shit. And I eventually went to San Diego and I was like, what is this? It was like a secret people were keeping, you know, and you could still get into Hall H back then. And so it was in Miami, it was very remote, very cut off. You couldn't find anybody who did anything, like who knew anybody. You know, we had comic shops, we had Toy Fair magazine, Wizard magazine, and then eventually message boards. And that saved me, is where I started to learn about that there are artists who do this professionally. I used to like follow different concept artists. I studied this business out of a sheer like lack of options. I know people. It's funny, like nowadays I meet people and they don't know that they're known, and maybe they aren't, but I know who they are. Like I know editors and inkers and all that shit, just because I was just absorbing everything I could in case one day I might need this information for whatever reason. So, you know, I've just always loved it. I never thought there would ever be a way I could get into it. So now I pinch myself, man. I can't believe it. Like sometimes I don't really believe that it's the same life. Like it's almost like one life ended, another one began. I mean it. Like it's crazy, dude. Like it's just wild. Like I have now 5 toys designed in my style, which happens to be a linoleum block print style. I was told by big name companies who's employed by friends of mine. It's not people who are not like nobody antagonistic, who make the most killer shit out there, stylized. And they said that my style would never work in 3D. It was too graphic. I didn't know better. I said, oh shit. Okay. Well, I'll keep trying. You know, and now there's 5 figures and you know, that are available. And then, and a few of them sold out. And then, you know, I was at Comic-Con and I got to, and I'm hanging out talking to Jim Lee and like Frank Miller and shit. Like, I feel like this is all bullshit. Like this is like how did it happen? You know, but it's your original question. Yeah. It was a desert out here.
Yeah, it's showing your perseverance, and it shows like how much. I mean, you're a very friendly, outgoing person, but you're also very talented. So I think mixing those two things together is napalm for networking. So.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's true. I try to be. I hate the gatekeeping energy that used to exist. I mean, that was the one thing that did exist in Miami. Like a lot of gatekeeping comic book shop owners when I was like a kid trying to get into comics. And I remember going to a comic book store like when I was like 11 years old or something and grabbing whatever Spider-Man, Venom, you know, Image, Spawn, all that stuff was popping. And I grabbed one. I'm like so excited. Mom, can we get this? And the comic book shop owner was an adult, you know, in front of my mom or my grandpa, whatever, was like, why are you reading that? Have you even read The Watchmen? And I'm like, dude, I'm fucking 10. Like, you know, like,
right.
That was the energy down here. And it was like, I'm very stubborn and hard headed and I hate the bullying energy. So I don't mind. I don't, you know, you can't hurt my feelings easily. So I just charge ahead. But I just remember it was very hard to get into it, you know, so.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned like, just like how, Florida is a little bit of a desert with certain things. Like, my buddy Pete, he's a promoter. He's a promoter now, but he was in a death metal band back in the day in Florida, and like how Florida, you know, with death metal made its own scene in general, like American death metal was very much born out of Florida. And it's just amazing. Like how, if there is no scene, you kind of make your own scene. And anytime I know or I've met people from Florida, like just like you, that's a vibe I get. Is like, if there is no scene, make your own scene.
100%, man.
That's one of the things that I really appreciate about people from Florida in general. It's just like, if you're not going to bring it to us, we're going to bring it to you.
Oh yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was in bands growing up my whole life, and in Miami there was a huge scene, and then it went away right when my band was starting to get good, and then we brought the scene back, and I got signed to Roadrunner Records at 19 years old. With my band at the time, which is the same label that has like Killswitch Engage and like, I don't know, forget who else, Slipknot at one point or Nickelback and all those bands, Glassjaw.
What was the name of your band?
It was called Twice the Sun. It was like it was like an Incubus meets Faith No More type thing back then. And it was like 2002. But my point was, like, again, like Miami specifically, it's literally the farthest point in Florida. And then, and so nobody comes down here. So the only reason we even got signed is an A&R guy came to see another band. We outplayed them. They went with us. But to your point, like, there must be something about that, because we all have chips on our shoulders down here, and we all have a very much and in Miami is an immigrant mentality. Like, you know, all my family's all from Cuba. And so, you know, my grandfather smuggled my mom and my aunt and my grandmother on the bottom of a fruit boat, like a banana boat, literally.
Wow.
And to get to this country, you know, so it's like, it's in my blood. Like I don't give up. We don't give up. And we don't mind, like, failing publicly, whatever it takes to get there. So that's interesting.
I really respect that. I mean, I'm a white dude, but one side of my family is Mexican. My great grandmother came from Monterrey, Mexico. So similar story, like,
hell yeah.
In terms of, like, doing whatever you can to make it work. She migrated from Monterrey, Mexico to Texas, and I'm here because of her hard work. So
it's in your blood, dude. It's in your blood. Like, that's, it's just a thing. Like, there's something about it, man, and it's hard to pinpoint, but I take it for granted here. The funny thing is, I meet a lot of people now from other parts of the country, especially a lot of people in cities where the entertainment industry is flourishing and always has been. And there is a difference, man. There is a difference where, like, it maybe because it's felt like it's within their grasp for a longer time geographically, versus me, where I'm like, dude, I have to, like, stretch to get a touch of this. And so, I don't know. I think that gives me an edge too. You know, it also, like, makes me a little bit resilient when it comes to, you know, shit going wrong. I don't mind. We'll put it back together, you know. But that's rad.
Right on.
Shout out to your grandmother. Is that an Urban Aztec hat, by the way?
It is. It is.
Yeah. Jesse's a man.
I used to work with Jesse.
No way.
Yeah. He and I both worked at Zynga for, like, hot minutes. So if you ever ask him about that, and then that's his Luchador mask right there.
Yes. Oh, hell yeah. I love that guy so much. We had a blast with him at DesignerCon. We went out drinking with him, Hector and I, and our families. And it's just so much fun. That guy's, I mean, you know, he's the best.
Yeah. Jesse has a heart of gold, and he's always a fun time.
Like, this big. When it beats, you hear it. Boom,
boom, boom. Actually, well, I'm going to jump around a little bit. I do want to come back to talking about your process, but
sure.
Let's kind of go there, just because, so you work for Mondo.
Yes.
And one of the things I really like about
nothing controversial there at all.
How was that controversial? One of the things I really appreciate is the fact that you guys have been more artist-centric recently. I know that you joined Mondo like a year ago or something like that, right?
A little over now. It was a year in November.
Congrats.
No, thanks.
Yeah, one of the things I really appreciate is the fact that you guys are, like, really artist-focused now. Between you, Jesse, James Grohman, I guess talk a little bit about that. Like, what inspired the company to be more artist-focused?
Well, so if you like look into the history of Mondo, it's a company that started with artists. So Mondo originally was a company formed around the idea of creating alternative movie posters, right? So that was its initial thrust, and started by Rob Jones, the great Rob Jones, who's over now at Vinyl Me Please. It's basically taking the gig poster mentality. So having different artists creating posters and artwork for different shows bands would play around the country, bring that to movies, and then do artist takes on movie posters. So it's always been the case that Mondo's been searching for that unique singular artist voice and trying to match it up properly with the right title, the right IP, whatever it is, you know, trying to make sure that artist succeeds, and the by way of the product, you know, selling well, et cetera. So what's interesting now is that the business has shifted substantially in the last, you know, 5-6 years, where the figure design that we do and the collectibles that we do have really started to take the majority of the spotlight, you know. And I think it's because in the last, you know, 20 years, other companies have come up to imitate the Mondo model of, you know, pairing an artist with a license and getting a new piece of artwork out of it. And not that that's easy to do at all. And I think there's varying degrees of success when it's done, but there's less of a hurdle to getting that done. You know, it almost seems to me like at some point every artist is going to have their own Mondo company built around them. You know, it's happening more and more. It just takes you either paying for a license to do it officially or dodging the licenses and doing it unofficially. But you can get a nice screen printed poster or G Clay of your artwork made. And that's easier to do now than it used to be. Collectibles in their hands, like final figures, 1/6 scale, that's a lot harder to do. Even if you have the skill and the talent and the know-how, it's difficult. It's very difficult. And we have an incredible team led by Hector Arce, who has, like, he has the real vision, and it's why I wanted to come work at Mondo originally. I left Skybound for a bunch of reasons, but the one reason I wanted to come to Mondo, I wanted to work with Hector. I'm a huge toy fan, collector of, you know, figures, Sufubi and all kinds of stuff. And so watching what Hector was doing from afar, I'm like, this guy is the fucking real deal, man. Like, he's doing the most with the least, honestly, because it's a tiny team. It's grown recently, thankfully, but he, you know, and he had a small handful of licenses they were working with, and so they're just crushing, and everything was a viral moment. And it's like, this guy's the man. And so we became friends over the years. And when I got to work with him, it became obvious that was going to be the same thing. We can do, you know, on model representations of characters like we've been doing with our Masters line, with our X-Men line. But what's going to set us apart is that we continue to find artists that we can create original pieces with, because what Jesse does, only Jesse does. You know, there's imitators, but there's only one Jesse. And so, you know, no company is going to reach out to Jesse and say, Jesse, let's do a Godzilla, because I'm sure we could convince Toho to do it, because that is not like what you would consider, you know. And so Sideshow had did some great stuff with Jesse for Marvel and DC and Star Wars. We loved it. We got a chance to do Godzilla with him, and it popped off, you know. With me, they were the first company to give me a shot of creating an IP character in my style. Hector's the one who said, we can do it. When I told you, everybody was like, we can't do it. Like, we can do it. And they translated it, and it was a huge success. And it was the first figure for any IP designed in the style of a linoleum block print, you know, so that took engineering and know-how and translating, yada yada. He surrounds himself with the best team, painters and sculptors, and it's just an awesome force to be reckoned with. But yes, to your original question, it's the utmost important thing that either we find artists whose styles are singular and recognizable, so that the product itself, the figures, are also singular and recognizable. Or at minimum, if we're working on model things like our 1/6 Motu line or X-Men or Batman the Animated Series, whatever, we always list and highlight the name of everybody involved, because you want to make sure that those people are recognized for their work as well, because it takes a lot of work.
Absolutely. Yeah. And speaking of surrounded by stuff, like, you're surrounded by some of your work that's come out recently.
That cool?
Your creature that just came out.
This cool prototype.
Yeah, it's so rad.
I love this thing. This is the first vinyl pull. So this one is just like a test to show that the articulation works out. And we like it. So right now it's already in the factory. I just saw some pictures where this is a cool thing. Like, they send you pictures and they ask you, how do you want it to appear, like, in the blister, like in the plastic blister when you pull it out of the box? Did you want it like this, or do you want it like this? And then when you tell them, they do a vacuum mold of it, right, for the plastic
that's awesome.
Inside the box. Yeah, it's cool, man. So this guy is on his way. Mechagodzilla is on his way. Like, Mechagodzillas will be arriving very, very soon to people who pre-order them. Yeah. So super cool.
Yeah, that's the thing I love about your artwork, is just like the lines are so iconic and interesting, and how you sneak like little tiny designs into each like intricate detail.
Yeah,
I really like that.
This one I really snuck in. That's little asterisk in the ear. The original Mechagodzilla's got like some circles in there, but the asterisks are like a little thing that I stole from tattooing that I put in all my designs. And so I snuck it in there, and they were cool with it. So that's cool.
Nice. That's awesome. I guess going back to the actual, like making block prints specifically, like what are ways that that medium challenges you compared to other mediums? Just like in terms of like gotchas or like things that are like really challenging about it that other mediums don't lend itself to.
I cut myself a lot with a blade and get blood all over. I don't see Daniel Warren Johnson cutting himself on his YouTube streams with his pens and inks. You know, I love that guy. But no, the thing with block printing is the challenges are there. It's just that you get used to them. But so, for example, everything's got to be in reverse. So everything has to be planned out in reverse, especially text, especially when you're doing Japanese text. You really got to be careful because I don't read Japanese. You know, I can read a few symbols maybe, but like Goji and Ra are the ones I know. Other than that, I don't know much. And so there's that. There's no erasing, obviously. Like if you slip with the blade, that's in the design now. And so you just have to like build it into your design. Over time, the linoleum block breaks down, doesn't print as clearly, you know. You have to really take care of those if you want them to last, but that's why we do limited runs anyway. And you know, aside from that, there is the fact that it's novel. So it's not everybody's cup of tea. So it's unlikely that Attack Peter artwork will ascend to the levels of Alex Ross, right? Or someone whose work is generally appreciated because you understand what you're looking at. So I'm very happy that I've, no pun intended, carved a niche in this landscape that I can, exist because of this work is very, it stands apart. There's now a lot more people doing it in pop culture, which is cool. You like seeing that. That means it's catching on, it's popular. But yeah, those are the big challenges, you know, prints, I gotta make each print. You know, the artists that I work with now, when I'm working with artists at Mondo, you know, when they're done, we scan the work or it's digital and we send it off to print. And the artist is done. The artist is done. When I'm done, then I got to start working. So it's like I just finished the next print I'm going to have this year for San Diego Comic-Con. And so now I got to start actually running the prints for it to be done in time. With everything else I do. So that's the challenge, but it's cool. There's not really anything like at this point, it's second nature to me. And in a way it's funny because the carving has forced my hand and my brain to think differently. And so my style almost doesn't exist without the medium. Like when I'm drawing, I'm slowly, like I'm working on a book now, the Takaro, the Last Dorok for Skybound. And that book, some of the artwork is block print, some of it's digital, but when I'm doing it digitally, I'm still trying to capture the linoleum block print feel. And as I'm doing that, I'm learning more and more about my style. Like what do I need for the drawing to feel like my artwork? So that's actually the challenging part is translating and adapting it elsewhere, you know?
Right. And you had a really successful Kickstarter for the Takaro figure as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you at in that process in terms of like everything?
Oh, Nick.
not to jab you in the ribs.
No, it's fine. The Kickstarter, we did it in the end of 2021. And yeah, it was super successful. It was for the Takaro, the last Takaro vinyl figure, black and white one, for the book Takaro, the Last Dorok. And then we had a baby Takaro plushie and a lot of other cool stuff in there. The book, has proved to be more of a daunting task than I think anybody anticipated. And part of that is because when we were originally thinking of the book, at first my only goal was I just want to do a book that collects my artwork. So if, you know, you could have all my artwork that I've done in one book, that was the goal. Then I'm like, okay, well, if we do that, we're gonna have to get the license permission from every IP to put it together. And that might work, might not work. Let's just do a book of like, you know, original kaiju monsters and things like that, just roaming the planet or their alien planet, you know, and we'll make it like a field guide. Like in this part of the planet, this happens. And then I'm like, who the fuck cares about that shit? Like, that is some self-indulgent shit. And so instead I said, let me see if we can come up with a story around this one character, Takaro, and then make it something like actually digestible. You know, I'm not Alan Moore. It's not going to blow anybody's mind with a plot twist or anything like that, but just like an A to B narrative, you know, something fun like that, some character arcs, stuff like that. And that's the idea everybody loved at Skybound. And so when the book and the Kickstarter was done, I had already started working on it a little bit, but you know, it became a large book. The script was finished back in last year, and I've been working on it ever since, but I still have like 50 illustrations left to do that are either linoleum block prints, like that are super densely detailed, like a big action scenes, or little vignettes and things like that. So I'm hoping to get it done this year. My God, and believe me, no one wants to get it done faster than I do, because I just don't want it to suck, you know, like, so I want to do it fast, but I don't want to sacrifice. I will not put anything out that's shit. I just won't do it. I'd rather people get mad at me, but I'm literally doing the work I do at Mondo as a creative director. So like overseeing posters, chipping in on toys, chipping in on records, and, you know, traveling for the company, going to conventions, doing interviews and stuff like that, and working on the book while taking meetings and doing the streams and the Patreon and stuff like that. So I'm a little topped off with, you know, bandwidth wise, but hopefully when the book is done, I can have a normal life again.
Yeah, so, looking forward to it. But yeah, for context, Takaro is the tentacle monster that's...
Yeah, this is a variant of him. This is actually the Mondo variant, because when we first designed the figure, Hector and the team at Mondo on the side worked on this before Funko acquired Mondo. So this was something they did to help out Skybound. They designed it. We sculpted the same people who did all my other figures, Tufan, Caesar, Hector, that whole group. And so this is the Mondo colorway. It's like these Vice City colors, because, you know, Takaro is the first kaiju from Miami. So he's got this cool removable dome, which was like such an accomplishment to get a cool dome on a figure. You know, he's like fully articulated his head, his tentacles all move, and his torso, he turns. It's cool. And then he's got like that whole carved texture style throughout. I love this thing so freaking much. So the black and white one was a Kickstarter exclusive, mm-hmm. but technically this one will probably arrive in homes before the black and white one. We're going to put it up for sale this year, I think around Monster Palooza in Pasadena. And then, and it'll ship almost immediately, because they are now arriving from overseas to the States.
Cool.
So yeah. But he's awesome. I think even if you don't know anything about the character or me, I just think if you're a cool toy collector and you like cool stuff, as a toy collector, I know I'm biased, but I think this is a awesome figure. Like, it's just an octopus character monster thing with a giant barrel chest and an eyeball and the dome. It's really good.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's just an amazing original design. And
thanks, sir. That.
Yeah, like... my last question is actually related to kaiju stuff. So I'll be questioning you there about more kaiju stuff. And, but yeah, I love it so much.
Thanks, man.
So I was talking about the challenges of like block printing and stuff like that. As far as like making pieces as well, cause like you've done 4 pieces with them with Mondo. Cause you did the Godzilla piece, Mechagodzilla.
The figures you mean?
The Daruma. Yeah.
Yeah. The Daruma I did over at Skybound, that was actually the first figure I ever did. Mm-hmm. We still have them available on the Mondo shop. Then after that was the original Godzilla, which I don't have here next to me, but that's the black and white Godzilla. That one came out in 2021. It was part of a Godzilla Museum series. It was like these smaller figures that Mondo was setting out to do. There was like different moments in Godzilla's history. After that line came out and did so well, Toho kind of said, hey, you can do more stuff and you don't have to worry about the size limitation. So, you know, you don't have to have a base. So we started to move into other areas, and that's where the ability to do these freestanding larger figures came, right? So this Mechagodzilla is the third figure I did with Mondo, and second figure I did with Mondo. Mm-hmm. And this one is 10 inches articulated. The original Godzilla is not articulated. This one turns and the head goes all the way around. It's just like not a production sample, so it's not that good. And there's a black and white one, there's this silver one, there might be another variant coming soon. And but this one, man, this one was like such a freaking honor to be able to work on, because that just, I just love that. I can't believe this is mine. Like, I look at this, I'm like, I would buy that.
That's so rad.
Yeah, man. But I get to do that there. So it's fun because, you know, I try to have at least one figure come out a year now is my goal. And sometimes, you know, variants. But to do that, you have to start like a year in advance because there's a whole process.
Right. Yeah. Are there any, talk about some of the specific challenges that you face on each of those pieces, like behind the scenes, or were there really, really tough challenges, technical challenges that you had to go over beyond just translating your art to 3D?
That is the challenge. So it's like, you know, when I'm designing, every time I do one of these drawings or whatever, they're just very here's my suggestion of how it might look like, you know? And then we get the art between Hector and I, we work on the concept art, like it should look like this from the front, bigger, taller, shorter, thinner, whatever, you know? And then we pass it on to the sculptor, the work he does to translate my work, you know, like bless him. It's a tough thing because it has to feel good in 3D, but it has to represent the 2D, you know, it has to still feel like the character enough. And so the challenge for me though is usually, can I find a stylized approach on the character that warrants me putting my name on the box? You know, so like with Godzilla, I had done Godzilla a few times. I knew what my take on Godzilla looked like. And with Mechagodzilla was more difficult because to me, that design of the original Showa Mechagodzilla from the 60s is perfect. 70s is perfect. 74 and 75. So what was I going to do to that? Anything I would have done to change it would have been blasphemous, in my opinion. So Godzilla suits have changed so many times that you can just have I like this part from here and this part from here and put it together, and it's kind of cool. But Mechagodzilla, like for me, you know, I had to start to do subtle things to it. Like, so I flared his eyebrows up really big. I added these engraved rings into his eyes that are technically there, but so faint in the original one, you'd never see them. I just played with, the patterning to give it the impression that I was creating values on a linoleum block print. Like, how would I create the effect of metal, you know, moving and fading and like in the iridescence of metal. So things like that, like making changes to the spikes and exaggerating them. So it is familiar enough, but when you hold it side by side with the real one, you see how much of a departure it is. So that's my thing, is like, how do I get this to feel like it's an Attack Peter quote unquote design without it feeling like hack, you know? Oh, you put three carve marks on it.
See, everything you just described, going back to your Alex Ross comment about, so for context, if anybody's listening, Alex Ross is like a really famous realistic comic designer who's like most known for like the Marvels and like Kingdom Come.
Yeah,
Kingdom Come is like one of the most iconic and most beautiful comic books that's ever been drawn. In fact, I've had people, like when I used to commute for work, I was on BART, and the first time I was reading Kingdom Come on the BART train, I realized there was somebody at least once a day like looking over my shoulder and like just staring at the art just because they were so enamored by it. But going back to what you're talking about, like, you know, when people talk about Alex Ross, they understand like, you know, what goes into it, because you can see it all in there. But like everything you just described about all the intention, and that's the thing that I really drive at on my show specifically, is like, I care about artists' intention. I care about like what drives people and like what they pay attention to, what they obsess over. And hearing you obsess over those little minute details, I think is like what makes artistry your artistry is so fascinating.
Thanks, man.
And it really shows, like, just like the level of detail that you do is just so stunning. So yeah, I really appreciate you being really articulate about all those little nitty gritty details that seem like that's not a big deal, but it goes in the overall look of what
it, yeah, it does. And you know, like the other thing about it that it's important to me is that I think a lot about my artwork from a business standpoint too. And then a lot of artists start to like shudder when I say that, but the reality is like, you know, I like paying my rent. So, and I don't want to have to do another job. So, you know, for me, when I talked earlier about how I wanted to be, have a style that was recognizable, part of that was just, I like that. I like that I could know who that is, you know, and even within more traditional illustrators, like when you see Art Adams, if you know Art Adams' work, you know it's his, right? So like there's a spectrum of it. But from a business standpoint, if you're doing something that people like and is not commonly or is not easily reproducible, you know, you got a supply and demand situation going on. Like, you know, you don't need as many people to love what you do as long as they love what you do, you know, and then you can have a support system around you. And that's where I've been able to leverage it, you know. And the other thing about this artwork is, after I explain it to you, you see it and you know it and you'll spot it everywhere going forward. It's a very much like a blue collar, you know, art style. Like, I got the lump of linoleum. I'm going to carve it out with a freaking blade and then I'm going to roll ink on it. I'm going to press the paper and there's your artwork. Right. So it's very like meat and potatoes, blue collar, but also it's very what you see is what you get. When you see it, you know what it is. And the cool thing about it is that if you wanted to try it, you could. You don't need to do anything fancy. You could go to your local art store, or go on Amazon, order a beginner's kit, and you could carve a stamp and make prints. And it's also a very democratic process. Like, because I'm making my own prints, I'm the means of production, right? I can decide how many I make. I'm the one who cranks them out. And every single one you get is handmade by me. Every print is, I made it, every single one. It's not the original art only, but the actual print. And so I think people connect to that in a world where we're getting more remote, more disconnected. We're connected like this, but we're disconnected in terms of like if I saw you in person, I'd give you a big high five and give you a hug and we'd hang out, right? But the artwork is tactile, the artwork is physical. So at least it communicates that way, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, especially just like the handmade portion of it, like the fact that you're sitting there on YouTube live cranking stuff out and talking to the audience and everything like that. And like it goes a long way just to show like how much work you put into it. And
thanks, man. I'm glad.
Yeah, it's really cool just to see the whole process. Going back to like all the IPs that you get to play with at Mondo specifically, you rattled off a whole bunch, Batman animated series, MOTU.
It's crazy.
Like, what excites you most about being able to play in those sandboxes of like the X-Men and other stuff like that?
Dude, the shit I've seen that you haven't seen yet, that you will see, it'll blow your fucking mind.
I've seen a lot of stuff for Designer Con, but even that stuff, I'm like, I'm sure he's got more stuff.
That was last year's shit. I'm already seeing this year's Designer Con shit. It is my fucking dream come true, dude. I swear to God that I used to read Toy Fair magazine. Do you remember that magazine? How old are you, Nick? Oh, yeah.
I'm 40. I'm
Me too. 40. Okay, so we're both the same age. Yeah. So like, Toy Fair magazine was the shit, right? Like, yes, and you're obviously an avid toy collector. With
Mego Theater and everything. Yeah.
Yes, dude. Yes. And so, I bumped into the editor with the big chops. I don't know if you remember him. I forget his name is escaping me now.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. He works at Gentle Giant now. And I saw him at a convention recently. I go, dude, Toy Fair. And he's like, yeah, Toy Fair. I'm like, holy shit. Like that was such an important part of my life. I had so many shit jobs. I worked at a Sears call center where I was in a cubicle on a Sunday morning trying to sell warranties for refrigerators. And the only thing that made my life like palatable at the time is I could sneak in my Wizard World or my Wizard or my Toy Fair and just kind of flip through it on the side when I was, you know. So the idea that I would look at these and go, there are people. I used to cut out pictures of like Action Figure magazine or Inside or whatever, and cut out the interviews with people like Dave Cortez, who sculpted all the Hellboy comic accurate figures for Mezco back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I would just put them on my room wall because you could see that the what the toys looked like when they were being sculpted by hand back then. They were made of this material called castelline. It was like this green waxy clay. And I'm like, that's just so fucking, what is this? And so I would plaster my wall with those articles. Just to, I think, I didn't think about it back then, but I think looking back, I was just reinforcing the idea that this was a profession that people did. This was a real career. And it felt so foreign back then. And then when I ended up becoming an art teacher, I was very happy teaching. You know, it doesn't pay very well, but it's very rewarding in other ways. As people tell you, it is true, but it's very difficult. And I just wanted to try. I wanted to try to be in this world. And so now, dude, like I'm telling you, I look around, I walk around at conventions like Comic-Con. And dude, everybody's bringing their A game these days. Like NECA farts out a legendary figure. Like they just go, and it's like the best figure you've ever seen. You know, it's like Super 7 is just like, here's another classic. Like it's just, that's the world we're in. But I walk around, dude, and I would put the Mondo stuff up against anybody. And just knowing that, I'm like, holy shit, I work here. And then I get to go, like, I have an app on my phone called Basecamp that like lets me see all the projects that we're working on. So sometimes I'm just like in the middle of meetings. I go, let me just see what's going on. I just scroll through like, holy shit, the box art looks amazing because we got so-and-so to design it. Oh my God, we're doing that colorway. So it's like, it is literally a dream. It is literally a dream that I love the people I work with. Everyone's nice. I'm in awe of them. I work with Alex Brewer, the sculptor, and Tommy Hodges. Like those guys are Alex Brewer pretty much did the entire X-Men line of the animated figures. Yeah, Tommy Hodges is doing like a ton of the He-Man stuff. Those guys are just like they're who I wanted to be as a kid, you know? And I just can't believe it. I honestly can't believe it. I shit you not. It's hard work. I'm exhausted. I pass out on the couch. Like I don't get to the couch at night till like 8:30, 9 o'clock most nights. But when I do, I'm just like, I just crash. But the whole day is like going to war for the best like team you could be on. Like it must be what it feels like to be on a football team that's like crushing or something. Like it's hard work. You get smacked around, you get trampled, but you're like, heck yeah, let's do it again. That's what it feels like.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I love it so much. And it's really funny to hear you describe you courting the Toy Fair guy and just point at him that way. I was definitely that way with James Grumman the first time I met him, just because he was such a huge fan of Madballs. It's like,
oh my God.
Remember that one time you made Hornhead? That was awesome.
That was awesome. Dude, I told him that story. I told him a story when I first met him. I have a great Madball story. Like my dad, my biological dad, you know, he's a fine guy, but he was not like thrilled with my love of toys as I got older, you know, like I'm talking about like 13. I wasn't even like in my late teens or anything. And when I was a kid, when Madballs was coming out, I wanted Madballs so bad, dude. I liked all the gross toys, like Madballs, Blurt Balls, like Barnyard Commandos. By the way, I think those are all Gromans and Boglins and all that. And so Madballs, they had that mummy ball.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about? Dust Brain. Yeah.
Dust Brain.
Yeah.
And I thought that was the coolest design ever. And I said, Dad, I just want a Madball. Can I get a Madball? And he looked at them and he was like, he was kind of going through this like reborn, like reborn Christian phase or something like that, where he was like into Nostradamus and it was the end of the world and all that shit. So he's like concerned that everything, it's like the satanic panic of the 90s. If you remember that shit, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's like, Peter, Madballs. Or bad balls. And so I never got to have them. Like I never got to have mad balls. And so later in life, I would get one or two on eBay there. I never got Dust Brain. I still to this day would love to get a Dust Brain. When I first met him, James Grimm, I told him that story and he cracked up so fucking much, laughed. And I was just thinking when I'm talking to him the first time I met him, and we've become friends ever since. I'm like, can you imagine if that was your dad growing up, like James Grumman? How fucking different from Madballs or Bad Balls to look at what I just did. You know what I mean? And his family loves him. Is like, he's like a family man. He brings his family to shows. But for my birthday one year, he sent me a giant King Corpse figure, an orange, like,
oh wow,
just pure orange variant. And then he drew a birthday card for me with an original Madball illustration on it. And it was so like touching because, I mean, first of all, it's fucking awesome. But second of all, I'm like, what a full circle fucking moment. What a full circle moment. I only wish that my dad was a little bit more with it. Now I can say, Dad, these are pretty good balls. You know, they're pretty good. And, you know, so it's a weird life, man. I don't know. I never know. I never feel like I know what I'm doing. I always feel like I'm skating by the skin of my teeth. And I'm always just, as long as everybody who is involved, if we're making stuff that people are excited about, if it's my stuff that people like, if it's the stuff that I work on, it's not my stuff that people like, I'm just happy to be around people who are happy because that we're doing all this stuff. It's just real simple. I have no delusions about what we do. We work on luxury items that are nostalgia plays. I get it. But it means something to me. I look at these things and I just feel like they are little charged totems of inspiration. Like my toy collection inspires me to go back to drawing. And now I have a toy collection of my own stuff that I drew. And that's pretty fucking awesome, especially when you consider, like I told you in the beginning, Miami, no connections, weird art style, didn't, you know, nothing. And so I harp on that because I would love for anybody who watches this stuff and hears it to look at whatever you're doing, and it can't be weirder than what I was doing. And so you can connect the dots. You can connect the dots. You just have to look at the landscape, see who's doing it the best. Where are you in the grand scheme of things, and how do you close that gap little by little, and try to just have fun and bring some joy to someone else. If your goal is, can I bring a little joy to someone else? It moves, and you always feel like you're doing good.
It's really funny that you talk about that story with James Roman. I had a similar experience when I talked to John Waters for the first time. because my mom was a huge fan of Hairspray, just because she really identified with that movie. But then she didn't realize that John Waters was John Waters. And of course, there's stuff like Pink Flamingos, which she hadn't seen. But we watched Serial Mom as a thing. For Thanksgiving, my mom was Catholic, hardcore Catholic, and knowing that, she's like, oh, I love John Waters, I love Hairspray, well, let's watch Serial Mom. And we watched it together as a family. She's like, that movie was disgusting. And I was like, so when I met John Waters, I was like, I want to thank you for ruining Thanksgiving for me. Like, it wasn't that bad. It's not like you watched your mom, like, you know, lick poop or something.
He's awesome, man.
Yeah, good stuff. Awesome. Well, Peter, I have one final question for you, and it's a pretty serious question. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. So here's the scenario. Gozer the Gozerian has asked you to summon a champion to fight Godzilla. Who do you turn into a kaiju to battle Godzilla?
Takuro. Easy. I'll tell you why. Takuro doesn't have that many cool powers. You'll see in the book. He doesn't really he doesn't breathe fire. He doesn't have like an ice power. He's the shortest kaiju of all the kaiju. Like, whoever you think is the shortest kaiju, he's a little shorter than that. And but what he does have is an incredible ground game. So he's got plenty of arms, got the leg power, he's got those big trunks. And so this guy is just going to get on your back and strangle you and bring you down. But once you submit, much like when Cesar Millan, you know, gets a dog to submit, he's gonna be like, hey, are we cool? You chilling? All right, let's go, man. Let's go. So Takuro, because not only would he whoop up on Godzilla, but he would also befriend him, and then they would go and take care of business. Not close.
Awesome. Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking. It's been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Is there anything that you'd like to plug before we take off?
No, if you don't know me or my work, you can find me anywhere at Attack Peter. I'm a creative director over at Mondo, so I'm always over there. We do Mondo streams on the Mondo YouTube channel. You can check out my stuff, Attack Peter, on YouTube, and just say hi. I'd love to know who I met through this stream. So for sure.
Awesome. Well, Peter, thank you so much. Thanks, dude. Everybody else, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.